A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about something we touched on in earlier conversations about governance failure in Israel. The term policy wonk gets thrown around a lot, often as a kind of put-down. But when you strip that away, what does the skill set actually translate to? What job descriptions do these people hold? What backgrounds do they come from? And how do they build a knowledge base that's genuinely useful to the policymakers they work with? It's a good question, because the term obscures more than it reveals.
It really does. And I think the first thing to say is that a policy wonk, stripped of the pejorative baggage, is someone with deep, granular knowledge of how a specific policy domain actually works. Not the theory, not the textbook version. The implementation details. They know which levers actually move when you pull them, which ones are rusted shut, and which ones will trigger three unintended consequences if you're not careful. Tax codes, healthcare financing formulas, education funding mechanisms, regulatory frameworks, these are the landscapes they navigate.
It's not just knowing that something exists, it's knowing which 3% of a 1,000-page bill actually matters.
And it's worth distinguishing the wonk from adjacent roles that often get conflated. A lobbyist advocates for a specific interest. They have a client. An academic publishes for peer review. Their audience is other scholars. A pure data scientist models without institutional context. They can tell you what the regression says, but not whether the agency in question has the staff to implement it. A wonk sits at the intersection of data, institutional memory, and legislative mechanics. They understand the policy substance, the political viability, and the administrative feasibility all at once.
The triple threat, or the triple headache, depending on your perspective.
It's worth noting, the best wonks are deeply political. Not in the partisan sense necessarily, but in the sense that they understand a policy proposal is worthless if it can't command enough votes. They're not dreaming up optimal solutions in a vacuum. They're designing things that can actually pass and actually work.
Let's get concrete. If someone is described as a policy wonk, what are the actual job titles they might hold? Where do they sit in the org chart?
There are a handful of archetypal roles. On Capitol Hill, you've got the legislative director for a member of Congress. That person manages the entire policy portfolio, juggling everything from defense appropriations to agricultural subsidies, and they're the ones who decide which issues the member prioritizes. Then there's the senior policy advisor who specialized in one domain, healthcare or tax or foreign affairs. These people typically have 10 to 15 years in their field. Below them, you've got legislative assistants and legislative correspondents, the junior wonks who handle constituent mail on specific issues and draft the first versions of talking points and bill language.
There's a pipeline. You start in the mailroom of policy and work your way up.
And then there's the committee staff. These are the people who actually run the machinery. A committee staff director for, say, the Senate Finance Committee manages a team of maybe 30 to 40 policy specialists, coordinates hearings, negotiates bill text with the minority staff, and interfaces with the Congressional Budget Office on scoring. These roles are less visible than the members themselves, but often more influential on the actual content of legislation.
Because the member is doing press conferences and fundraising calls, while the staff director is on the phone with the CBO at 11 at night, trying to figure out if a particular provision will add $12 billion or $14 billion to the deficit.
That 12 versus 14 billion distinction can be the difference between a bill living or dying. The Byrd rule in the Senate reconciliation process has very specific deficit thresholds. If you blow past them, your entire bill can be challenged on a point of order, knowing exactly where those lines are. That's wonkery in its purest form.
That's the Hill. What about outside of Congress?
Think tanks are the other major ecosystem. You've got policy analysts at places like the Urban Institute, the Brookings Institution, RAND, the Heritage Foundation, the Center for American Progress. These are the people producing the white papers, the policy briefs, the cost estimates that eventually get picked up by legislative staff and turned into actual bills. At the more senior level, you've got fellows and senior fellows, people with 15 to 20 years of experience who are the go-to experts in their domain. And then there are the campaign-adjacent policy shops. The policy director for a presidential campaign, for instance, who has to translate a candidate's broad vision into specific, costed proposals that can survive a general election debate.
At the state and local level,
a director of policy for a governor or a mayor. These people are translating campaign promises into executive orders and budget proposals. They're working with agency heads to figure out what's actually implementable. In a large city like New York or Los Angeles, the mayor's policy director might oversee a team of 10 to 15 people covering everything from housing to transportation to public health. And at the county level, you've got policy analysts embedded in departments like Health and Human Services who are the ones who actually understand how federal block grants flow down to local programs.
There's a whole ecosystem here that most people never see. These aren't the names in the newspaper, but they're the ones who wrote the thing the names in the newspaper are arguing about.
And let me give you a concrete example of how this works in practice. The Affordable Care Act, love it or hate it, was shaped in large part by a small group of staffers on the Senate Finance Committee who had spent years studying what happened in Massachusetts. The 2006 healthcare reform there, Rodney Care, was their blueprint. They knew which design elements had worked. The individual mandate, the subsidies structured as advanceable tax credits, the essential health benefits package. And crucially, they knew which elements would collapse under adverse selection if you got the design wrong. The individual mandate wasn't an ideological choice. It was a technical necessity to prevent the insurance pool from becoming a death spiral where only sick people signed up.
Because without the mandate, healthy people stay out, premiums spike, more people drop out, premiums spike further, and the whole thing implodes.
This wasn't theoretical. They had the Massachusetts data. They could see exactly what the enrollment patterns were, what the risk corridors looked like, what happened when you adjusted the subsidy thresholds. That's wonkery in action. It's not glamorous. It's sitting in a windowless room reading actuarial reports. But it's the difference between a bill that functions and a bill that collapses on contact with reality.
The Clinton healthcare effort in 1993, that was the cautionary tale they were all trying to avoid, right?
The Clinton plan was drafted in secret by a task force of about 500 people led by Ira Magaziner, with very little input from the congressional committees that would actually have to pass it. It was over 1,000 pages long and incredibly prescriptive about things like regional health alliances. The Senate finance staffers who worked on the ACA had all studied that failure. They knew they needed to build something that the committees could own, that had buy-in from key stakeholders like the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical companies, and that could survive the legislative gauntlet.
Institutional memory isn't just a nice to have. It's the thing that prevents you from repeating a catastrophic failure.
That's one of the key ways wonks build useful knowledge. It's not just reading white papers, it's a systematic process. First, comparative case analysis. Studying how 10 different states implemented Medicaid expansion and which design choices produced better outcomes on cost, access, and health metrics. Second, institutional memory. Knowing that the 1996 welfare reform had a hidden provision that still affects SNAP eligibility today, or that a particular regulatory waiver process was created in 1987 for a completely different purpose, but now governs how states can experiment with Medicaid.
The ghosts of legislation passed.
And third, relationship networks. The best wonks have the phone numbers of the career staff at the Department of Health and Human Services who know where the bodies are buried in the regulations. The political appointees come and go every 4 to 8 years. The career civil servants have been there for 30 years. They know that a particular regulation was written in 1992 to solve a problem that no longer exists, but it's still on the books and it still constrains what you can do. If you don't know that person, you don't know that constraint.
The knowledge base is part data, part history, and part Rolodex.
The educational path matters too, though it's not the whole story. Most wonks start with a master's in public policy, an MPP, or a related field like economics, or a JD with a policy focus. Programs like the Harvard Kennedy School, Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, Georgetown's McCourt School, these are the traditional feeders. But the critical credential isn't the degree. It's Hill experience. spending 2 to 4 years as a staffer, ideally 5 to 10. The real education happens in the trenches, drafting bill language, writing committee markups, negotiating with the CBO for score estimates.
The CBO deserves its own moment here, because you mentioned them several times. What actually is the CBO, and why does it have so much power?
The Congressional Budget Office employs roughly 250 analysts, economists, health policy specialists, tax experts, whose entire job is to produce cost estimates for every major piece of legislation. When a bill is introduced, the CBO scores it, meaning they estimate how much it will cost or save over a 10-year window. That score is make or break. If the CBO says your health care bill will add $300 billion to the deficit, you've got a massive problem. If they say it'll save $200 billion, you've got a massive selling point.
These are career people, not political appointees.
The director is appointed by the House and Senate budget committees, but the analysts are career civil servants. They're not supposed to be partisan. Their methodology is public, their assumptions are documented, and both parties have learned, sometimes painfully, that you can't just dismiss a CBO score you don't like. The 2017 effort to repeal the ACA died in part because the CBO scored various repeal bills as causing 20-plus million people to lose coverage. Those numbers were politically devastating.
Let's talk about the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, because that's another case study in wonkery.
That bill was drafted almost entirely by a handful of staffers on the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee who had been working on tax reform since the 1990s. These people had been waiting for their moment for 2 decades. They knew the tax code inside out. They knew exactly which provisions would trigger the Byrd rule in reconciliation, the rule that says a provision can't increase the deficit beyond the 10-year budget window. That's why several of the individual tax cuts were designed to expire after 2025. It wasn't an oversight. It was a deliberate design choice to fit within the reconciliation constraints.
The fact that we're now having a debate about extending those cuts isn't a glitch. It was the plan all along.
It was the plan. And the people who drafted that bill knew that the corporate tax cut, reducing the rate from 35% to 21%, would be permanent because they could offset it with other revenue raisers over the long term. But the individual cuts had to be temporary to make the math work. That's the kind of detail that only a handful of people in the country truly understood at the level required to draft the legislative text.
We've established what a wonk is and where they come from. But here's where it gets tricky. When you're building an opposition movement from scratch, you don't have a 20-year institutional memory to draw on. You don't have committee staff. You don't have people who've been marinating in the tax code since the Clinton administration. So, how do you build one?
This is the central challenge, and it's where a lot of movements fail. The Tea Party wave in 2010 is the classic cautionary tale. They won elections, 63 House seats, a historic landslide, but they had almost no policy infrastructure. No detailed alternatives. No legislative language ready to go. They had a lot of energy and a clear message about what they were against, but when it came time to govern, they were reactive. They could block things, but they couldn't build things.
The repeal and replace problem in miniature. They had the repeal part figured out. The replace part was a blank sheet of paper.
Contrast that with the 1994 Republican contract with America. That was built by a network of wonks at the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute who had spent 18 months drafting 10 specific bills with detailed legislative language. They had cost estimates. They had talking points. They had answers to every obvious objection. When Newt Gingrich and the Republican caucus unveiled it 6 weeks before the election, they weren't just saying, "We're against the Democrats." They were saying, "Here are 10 specific things we will pass in the first 100 days." And they did pass most of them.
The Heritage Foundation team. How many people actually wrote that?
About 12 policy analysts working over 18 months. That's it. A dozen people in a conference room produced the intellectual architecture for a political revolution that reshaped American politics for a generation. The contract itself was drafted by a core team led by policy analysts who had been working on these issues for years. They knew the legislative mechanics, they knew what could pass, they knew what would score well with the CBO. It wasn't magic. It was methodical, grinding work.
The lesson for an opposition movement is, you need your 12 people in a conference room.
You need them early. You can't scramble to put this together 6 months before an election. The contract with America Team started working in early 1993, nearly 2 years before the 1994 midterms. They had time to draft, redraft, vet with subject matter experts, run the numbers, and anticipate every attack line the Democrats would use. By the time the campaign was in full swing, the policy work was done.
Let's bring this international, because the prompt is really about the question of building viable opposition, and the Israeli context is the starting point. What are the examples from other countries of movements that did this well?
The Chilean student movement of 2011 is a fascinating case. It started as street protests, massive ones, hundreds of thousands of students demanding education reform. But unlike a lot of protest movements, they had a dedicated policy team. These weren't just kids with signs. They had education economists, legal scholars, and policy analysts who produced detailed proposals for how to reform Chile's voucher-based education system. They could tell you exactly how the funding formulas worked, what the constitutional constraints were, and what specific legislative changes would be required.
That translated into actual policy outcomes?
When Michelle Bachelet returned to the presidency in 2014, her major tax reform, which raised corporate taxes to fund education, was shaped directly by the policy work the student movement had done. The students didn't just win the argument in the streets, they won it in the ministries, because they had people who could sit down with the technocrats and speak their language.
That's the bridge. You need people who can translate between the energy of a movement and the machinery of government.
The UK provides both a positive and a cautionary example. The 1997 Blair campaign had a dedicated policy unit that spent years developing specific, costed proposals. The New Deal for Young People, a welfare-to-work program for 18 to 24-year-olds, wasn't a slogan. It was a detailed program with funding mechanisms, eligibility criteria, and performance metrics. They knew exactly how much it would cost and how they would pay for it.
Versus the Corbyn era.
The Corbyn leadership from 2015 to 2019 had a much weaker policy infrastructure. Manifesto commitments were often drafted in isolation by the leader's office without proper costing or feasibility analysis. The 2019 manifesto in particular had a reputation for promising things that sounded good but hadn't been stress-tested. And when you're in opposition, you're going to be attacked on credibility. If you can't defend the numbers, you lose the argument before it even starts.
The number of special advisers in the UK government grew from 38 in 1979 to over 100 by 2019. That's a proxy for the professionalization of policy advice, right?
And it reflects a broader trend across democracies. Policymaking has become more complex, more technical, and more data-driven. You can't just wing it with a few clever speechwriters and a good gut instinct. You need people who understand the models, the data sets, the regulatory frameworks. The days of the gifted amateur running a government department are over, or they should be.
Let's get into the data dimension specifically. You mentioned that modern wonks need to be data savvy. What does that actually mean in practice?
It's not just reading regression tables. It's understanding administrative data quality, knowing which government data sets are reliable and which are garbage. The Census Bureau's American Community Survey, for instance, is the gold standard for demographic data in the United States. It's methodologically rigorous, it has large sample sizes, and it's updated annually. On the other hand, some self-reported crime data, like certain FBI uniform crime reporting categories, have known issues with underreporting and inconsistent definitions across jurisdictions. A good wonk knows the difference.
It's not just, what does the data say? It's, should I trust this data at all?
That's a skill that takes years to develop. You also need to be able to run, or at least interpret, cost-benefit analysis using tools like the Urban Institute's Tax Policy Center microsimulation model or the CBO's dynamic scoring framework. Dynamic scoring, by the way, is controversial and worth understanding. Traditional scoring, static scoring, assumes that tax changes don't affect overall economic growth. Dynamic scoring tries to model how tax changes affect growth, which then feeds back into revenue estimates. It's more realistic in theory, but it's also more sensitive to assumptions. Small changes in your growth assumptions can produce wildly different revenue estimates.
Which means the wonk, who controls the assumptions, controls the score.
That's why both parties fight so hard over who runs the CBO and what methodology they use. The wonk fights are often the most consequential fights in Washington, and nobody pays attention to them.
Let's talk about the opposition challenge more directly. If you're building a movement, whether in Israel or anywhere else, and you want to transition from protest to governance, what's the concrete playbook?
Step 1. Identify 3 to 5 priority policy domains. You can't be expert in everything. Pick the areas that matter most to your movement's vision. Housing, healthcare, education, corruption reform, whatever it is, and go deep rather than wide. A movement that has detailed, costed proposals in 5 areas and nothing else is far more credible than a movement that has vague position papers on 50 topics.
Depth over breadth.
Step 2. Recruit domain experts who are willing to do the grunt work. And I want to emphasize the grunt work part. Comparative analysis. Studying how different jurisdictions have tackled the same problem is tedious. Legislative drafting is tedious. Running cost estimates is tedious. You need people who find that work satisfying, not people who just want to be on television.
The glory to grind ratio in policy work is heavily skewed toward grind.
Step 3. Create a formal policy shop. This is a nonprofit or campaign adjacent entity. A 501c4 in the U.S. context, or the equivalent in other countries, that produces white papers, model legislation, and cost estimates. It needs a budget, staff, and a clear mandate. The Heritage Foundation's contract with America team had all 3. They weren't volunteers working on weekends. They were full-time professionals with salaries and deadlines.
A movement that spends all its money on rallies and advertising and nothing on policy infrastructure is building a house without a foundation.
Step 4. Build relationships with career civil servants. This is often overlooked because movements tend to be anti-establishment by nature, and career bureaucrats are about as establishment as it gets. But these are the people who know what's actually implementable. They've been in the agencies for 20 or 30 years. They've seen administrations come and go. They know which reforms worked and which ones died on the vine because the agency lacked the capacity to implement them.
It's like adopting a feral cat. The relationship between a movement and the civil service. You need them. They're wary of you. And if you approach them wrong, they'll disappear under the porch and you'll never see them again.
Actually, not a bad analogy. And the key is respect. Career civil servants aren't the enemy. They're the institutional memory of the state. If you treat them as obstacles to be routed around, you'll lose access to the very knowledge you need to govern effectively.
Let me ask you something about the incentive structure here. Why would someone choose to be a wonk rather than, say, a lobbyist who makes 3 times the salary?
That's a real tension. The financial sacrifice is significant. A mid-career policy analyst at a think tank might make $80,000 to $120,000. A lobbyist with the same level of expertise can make $300,000 to $500,000 or more. The wonks who stay in the policy world tend to be motivated by something other than money. Intellectual satisfaction, public service, the desire to shape outcomes rather than just advocate for an interest.
Or they're just too stubborn to leave.
There's some of that too. But the brain drain to the private sector is a real problem. When the best tax policy minds leave the Hill for K Street, the legislative process loses institutional knowledge, and replacing that knowledge takes years.
Which creates a vicious cycle. The less expertise there is inside government, the more government has to rely on outside lobbyists for information, which makes the lobbyists even more powerful, which makes it even harder to retain talent in government.
This is one of the arguments for strengthening the career civil service and making policy staff positions more attractive. Better pay, clearer career paths, protection from political purges. Let's say a legislator is considering voting for a drug pricing bill. The wonk's job is not to tell them whether drug pricing reform is good or bad in the abstract.
Let's address some misconceptions head on. The biggest one, I think, is that policy wonks are just boring academics who don't understand politics.
And they need to do it in a 2-page memo, not a 200-page report. Because the legislator has 15 minutes to make a decision and they need the essential information, not the bibliography. And here's the thing. The 2-page memo is harder to write than the 200-page report. Anyone can dump everything they know onto the page. The skill is in knowing what to leave out.
The 2-page memo. That's the deliverable. Not the expertise, not the credential, not the hours of analysis. The 2-page memo that tells the legislator what they need to know and what to do about it.
Data is only as good as the institutional knowledge that interprets it. A regression model can tell you that a particular intervention reduces hospital readmissions by 8%. Writing that memo is a craft. It's not just summarizing, it's synthesizing. It's knowing what to leave out. It's anticipating the three questions the legislator is going to be asked by the press and pre-answering them. It's understanding that the legislator's real concern might not be the policy itself, but the political vulnerability it creates, and addressing that honestly. You're not just providing information, you're providing a decision-making framework.
The third one, that think tanks are all partisan hack factories.
Some are, and they're explicit about it. Heritage is conservative, CAP is progressive, and they don't pretend otherwise. But many think tanks produce rigorous, nonpartisan analysis that's used by both parties. The Urban Institute, RAND, the Brookings Institution, their work is cited in both Democratic and Republican legislation. The partisan ones serve a real function too, by the way. They provide the intellectual ammunition for their side. The second misconception is that wonks are just boring academics who don't understand politics. The best wonks are deeply political.
What are the actionable takeaways here? If someone listening to this is involved in building an opposition movement in Israel or anywhere else, what should they actually do?
They know exactly which members are persuadable and which are not, and they tailor their analysis accordingly. That's not being apolitical. That's being politically sophisticated in service of policy goals. This is more important than advertising, more important than rallies, more important than social media presence. Those things build visibility. The policy shop builds the capacity to govern.
The depth of domain knowledge is the thing. And I think that's actually liberating. It means the path is open to anyone willing to do the work.
I think that's actually the most important message for someone who's listening and thinking, I might want to do this. You don't need permission from an institution. You need to pick a narrow domain and go deep for 12 months. Read every NSSEC committee protocol, every state comptroller report, every academic paper, then write a 10-page memo synthesizing what's broken and what would fix it. That memo is your job application. And I've seen people get hired off the strength of a memo like that. Not a resume, not a credential. A memo that demonstrated they understood the problem better than the people already working on it. You want to be the person that the member of Congress calls at 10 p.m. and says, what happens if we change the phase-in period from 3 years to 5? And you can answer without looking anything up.
The human search engine.
This is not optional. It's the difference between protest and governance. And I want to be really direct about this. If your opposition movement has more communication staff than policy staff, you are not serious about governing. You're serious about messaging. Those are different things. If you can bring a few senior civil servants into your policy shop, people who've been inside the agencies and know where the skeletons are, you got an enormous advantage.
That's the level of detail that separates a government in waiting from a protest movement with better branding.
For citizens who are trying to evaluate whether an opposition party is serious, the question to ask is not just what do they stand for, it's who is their health policy person. Can that person name the last three reform attempts and why they failed?
We've made the case for the wonk, but there's a tension here that I think is worth sitting with. How do you rehabilitate the term policy wonk in the public imagination? That's a filter most voters never apply. We ask about values and vision and charisma. We don't ask who's going to write the bill.
That's the democratic accountability question, and it's not trivial. The wonk class, like any expert class, can become insular. Let me pull on one more thread here, because the question also asked about data literacy specifically, and this is an area where the skill set is more technical than people realize. A wonk doesn't just read reports. They know how to request raw data from government agencies, through FOIA in the UR, through equivalent mechanisms in other countries. They know how to clean that data.
Sometimes the thing that's technically correct is politically combustible, and the wonk bubble doesn't always see it coming.
These are specific technical skills that can be learned, but they require practice and a certain skepticism toward official numbers. People who've been teachers or nurses or small business owners, not just career policy professionals. People who've lived in the communities affected by the policies they're designing. The wonk class needs to be porous, not a closed guild.
And it's not that complicated once you understand it, but most people never learn to check for it.
I'll give you a concrete example. A government might release a report saying average wait times for a procedure have improved. The wonk requests the raw data and discovers that wait times improved dramatically in the wealthiest districts and got worse everywhere else. The average looks good, but the reality on the ground is that most people are worse off.
The wonk speaks CBO score. The communicator speaks kitchen table.
The minister stands up and says, wait times are down, and the opposition MK can say, let me show you the district, by district breakdown. That's a completely different hearing. Some of the most effective people in politics are the ones who can take a complex regulatory proposal and turn it into a 30-second ad that doesn't distort it beyond recognition.
You learn to always look at the distribution, not just the average. These are habits, not talents.
It shifts from manual analysis to interpreting model outputs and understanding their limitations. AI can run 1,000 simulations of a tax proposal in seconds. What it can't do is tell you that one of your assumptions is wrong because of a regulatory quirk that isn't in any dataset. The core skill, knowing how policy actually works in practice, knowing the institutional landscape, knowing which questions to ask, becomes more valuable, not less, as the computation gets commoditized.
The wonk becomes the person who knows when the model is lying to you.
Or when the model is telling you something true but irrelevant. An AI can optimize a policy for cost-effectiveness and produce something that's politically impossible. The wonk's judgment. What can pass, what can be implemented, what won't blow up in your face 3 years later. That's not something you can train a model to do. Not yet, anyway.
We've covered a lot of ground. I think the core argument here is that policy wonks aren't the boring footnote to politics. They're the infrastructure. Without them, you get vibes and slogans. With them, you get a government.
The term itself. I think we should reclaim it. Wonk shouldn't be an insult. It should be a job description for the people who do the unglamorous essential work of figuring out how to actually make things better. Every successful reform, every functional program, every piece of legislation that actually improved people's lives, somewhere behind it was a wonk who did the reading.
The reading nobody else wanted to do.
The 1,000 pages nobody else wanted to read. The CBO score nobody else wanted to understand. The regulatory history nobody else knew existed. That's the craft. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The mantis shrimp has the most complex eyes in the animal kingdom. Each eye contains 12 types of photoreceptor cells, compared to the human eyes, 3. But here's the twist. Despite this hardware advantage, experiments in the 1950s showed that mantis shrimp are actually worse than humans at distinguishing between similar colors. They seem to process color information in a completely different way, faster but less nuanced, essentially trading resolution for speed.
They've got the world's fanciest camera, and they're using it as a motion detector.
That's unsettling.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtoff for keeping the show running. If you found this useful, share it with someone who's building something. A movement, an organization, a policy team. And if you want to go deeper on how to measure whether these systems are actually working, check out the Democracy Dashboard episode. We're at My Weird Prompts.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.